Hi, my name is Greg Feinberg. I am the executive producer of Deadwood and also the director of this episode. I have been with the show since the very beginning, the pilot, and on the last two seasons, and currently we're shooting season three. There's a lot of mystery surrounding the horse that you just saw running across the screen. David Milch mentioned in commentaries last year that he had no idea what that horse was all about. The horse came about when we were trying to figure out how to do the credit sequence. And we were putting some edits together and used footage from another movie of this horse running through the wilderness. It sort of appeared he was running to Deadwood in our minds. And we had all kinds of different credit sequences that we were trying out, one even involved using insects. It was absolutely fascinating, but somehow inappropriate in the end. So we decided at the last minute to go with images of this horse coming to Deadwood and other images that you're seeing, images of that pertain essentially to Deadwood. Gold here, for instance, of course, is the reason everyone came to Deadwood. I don't think the horse came to Deadwood for gold, though. So the horse was something that we were shooting the very last day of Deadwood, season one, out at the creek location. And the day before, we had discovered this patch of woods, and we decided at the last minute to bring a horse in and try to just shoot our own footage so we didn't have to buy the footage from the movie. We ended up getting all this fabulous footage and incorporated it into our main title. While David said he didn't understand what that horse was all about or didn't know why it was there, I think you'll see as you watch the season that that horse will come to have great significance this year. The way that David works is phenomenally interesting. A lot of people, including himself, talk about his process. And I've been, I have to say, privileged to be witness to it for the last 2 years. As with the horse, he'll discover things that, you know, just kind of appear for whatever reason, whether it's something that an actor does or something that somebody says, and just starts to incorporate it into his storytelling if it seems to fit. It always does seem to fit with David, and I think that's why the show is so brilliant. He's a man who's always thinking on his feet.
Will you talk? Cockeyed boss, all you want, long as you want.
It's really interesting to be a director on Deadwood. This actually is the first episode I've ever directed. David offered me the chance to do it, and I would have been a fool to say no. But we've had many very experienced directors who've come and worked with us.
Naming your adversary shows your memory's intact.
You're gonna have to gather all you fucking wilds, Al. All these developments that need interpreting on every front.
His process is such that when he writes, I believe, that he basically, for lack of any better description, he leaves his ego at the door. He walks into the writing room and leaves his own thoughts and his own sort of ego at the door and lets the muse speak to him, I think. It's amazing to watch him work. And watch how things just somehow develop for him.
Well, there ain't nothing to it.
And he
now
puts these amazing words together.
I just told you for a giggle.
And then we all get to bring him to life. It's just a fascinating process. And I think for directors, most of whom spend most of the time being the one in charge, fully in charge, we also have to leave our ego at the door and be willing to live into his process and walk onto that set and let him bring a scene to life for us and then capture it on film. And I think the people who've been working with us have done an unbelievable job of doing that over the last couple of years. I hope I've done the same here.
I best help. If there's anybody that can fuck up the gathering of a bell, it's Johnny.
You want some water?
Yeah. Fucking water.
This episode in particular was really a pivotal episode for the season, because this was the episode when Ian McShane's fabulous character, Al Swearengen, sort of came back.
Don't be a fucking jerk.
In this particular scene, he's not so sure he wants to come back.
Your right eye is spilled.
Waking up
blood.
After having that prod violate his body to discover he's also had a stroke.
put your nose between our fingers, you find out much I can squeeze my fucking arm.
And isn't so sure that it's worth it to keep going.
Don't bullshit me.
I won't.
This is hopefully a long-running series, and I think he may just stick around.
Strain of that stone.
Keep bullshitting them.
It was pretty interesting to watch Ian spend hours in the makeup chair to get all that gook put on his face. I thought our makeup team did a phenomenal job.
Get out.
If I need it, you will fucking kill me.
You stop that.
You find me no better.
He seemed so pained since that fight in episode one, and then through the situation with his kidney stones, and now this. Ian can pull just about anything off. He certainly pulled that off.
Madam, in the chambers of my heart beats a love.
Bill Sanderson is another one of our phenomenal acting troupe, another one of our great actors. Way back there in the background is Ralph Richardson.
It's warped floorboards.
He is an interesting story on Deadwood. He originally was simply cast as a background player, also known as an extra, as the cook at the Grand Central Hotel. When we first started the series, we had about 150 people come to work as background for us, and we had sort of a training day, and everybody got to choose a role. We chose some, and they got to choose some. We asked everybody to pick a vocation, whether they were a miner, or they worked in the camp, or they were selling whiskey, or whatever. And a lot of the guys are still with us, some women, very few women in town, of course.
Escort me on an errand.
Would you prefer other company, ma'am? Less...
And Ralph was the cook. And slowly but surely he was fed some lines, and he's sort of become a great character for the show. An awfully funny character. Very great facial expressions.
I saved a lot. I'll mop the rest in a moment.
Go with Mrs. Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Bonham.
Eyes down.
This in particular I love when Farnum says, "Eyes down."
As for your
and he looks down and walks out.
Purchase my hotel.
He's certainly infatuated with Alma.
Decline.
But he will obey his master at all costs.
I take you for the man in charge.
This was the first time in the series that we were able to see Merrick's printing office.
For the moment,
or the Deadwood Pioneer office.
Hugo Jarry, county commissioner appointed by Governor Pennington.
Of this county?
Yes.
As our county a name?
This is Commissioner Jarry. He's the first time that Merrick, the journalist, has realized that there's a commissioner in town and that there's even counties now.
My father was the newspaperman. Lowell
Sentinel. And I couldn't resist having a government official fondle that phallic symbol there.
Great,
it just seemed appropriate to me.
State. Here's a statement to be printed.
Very thematic in our show, obviously. The organization of society and
to ownership of
law and order,
in the newly constituted
and that just seemed the right thing to do.
As
it was very impromptu.
A presumption of legitimate title shall obtain for claims worked actively and continuously prior to amendment of the treaty with the Sioux Nation, September 1876. This presumption shall be subject to qualification according
this
to mitigating
facts. This next shot also lend itself to a little humor in terms of what the government official might have been doing down there.
The statement could be taken to mean nothing.
This statement continues.
I will say on our show we are blessed with just
new title
phenomenal
will be
actors.
On claims to which title is denied.
Really, each and every one of them. And also in David Milch's process, very often he'll write pages the day before, sometimes even the day of, and very, very often on the set he will watch a scene going, getting up on its feet, and then discover that there's something new and fresh that he hadn't even thought of to add to it. He might add a line of dialogue, sometimes he'll add a page of dialogue. And these actors just pick it up and run with it. And it's part of what I think makes this show feel so fresh and so real and so alive.
It's
how everybody bands together.
In any case, sir, being the commissioner
of
this county and bidding
in support of David's vision.
I have presented you with that to publish in your paper.
David is an extremely generous man in just about every way. I think we've put a crew together of extremely talented artisans that really want to bring his vision to life. This is also a very interesting moment. Those antlers there end up becoming a character themselves in this show. David had Molly Parker, Alma Garrett out there on the street and said, you know, she'd be standing out there, she'd need some sort of protection.
May we go there then, Richardson?
So he just reached down and said, why don't you just grab these antlers, just like your hand just reaches down and you don't even know what's really happening. Your hand just takes a life of its own and picks up those antlers. And now, of course, she doesn't know really what to do with them as she's walking down the thoroughfare with those in her hand. Ultimately, Richardson takes possession of them, and you'll see later that they become quite significant to him as a symbol of Mrs. Garrett. And they stick around for a while, those antlers.
And probably that's all either of us needs to say on
this episode. This scene was shot on the very first day that we were shooting this episode. It lends itself to a story about the difference between being an executive producer and a director. When it was getting towards the end of the day, and of course on my first day of directing, I was over schedule for the day. And I remember the supervising producer and co-producer, Scott Stevens and Hilton Smith, respectively, came up to me. These are two gentlemen that helped me on a daily basis tirelessly keep this show running. And they had that look in their eyes, a look that I often have in my eyes when I'm going to directors to say, you know, you better get moving. I remember they looked at me and I said, you know what, guys? I know that look. I don't want that look. I don't want to ever see that look again. And they kind of smiled at me and turned around and walked away, kind of winked at me. And they never really gave me the look again. And they let me do my thing. A lot of what you see there, these are the two guys that really keep that show running. My hat's off to them for the hard work that they do every day. I also love the juxtaposition of words with images. Interesting that another theme in this show, it deals with the women, Trixie and Alma, two characters that you wouldn't expect to ever become friends. So interesting that in an episode where that becomes evident, the last thing you hear before Trixie sees Alma is the word cunt.
You knocked up.
It happens more than once in this episode.
Why would you ask? You wouldn't have come here first.
Another character that you don't ever get to see or hear in our show that happens behind the scenes are airplanes and trains. The ranch where we shoot this show is located directly under the flight path for four major airports in Los Angeles. So this particular scene holds the record for the number of planes. There's also a train, by the way, the Metrolink that goes past the ranch about 3 miles away and happens to blow its horn for about 4 miles straight as it goes through intersections. So this particular day, I believe we had 43 interruptions from planes or helicopters or trains. In fact, the mayor of Santa Clarita, which is the town which we actually shoot in, was touring somebody around by helicopter, showing them our ranch while we were shooting. So somehow these two great actresses were able to pull out a performance that I thought was one of the more touching of the season amongst interruptions nonstop. What normally would have taken us about 2 hours to shoot took us about five because of the interruptions. And that happens on a daily basis where we shoot, but usually not to that extent. It's a testament to our sound mixer, Jeff Patterson, that you can never hear the dialogue at all.
Let me finish up my Jewish lessons here. Then come find you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Trixie.
All right.
My name's Alma.
I know your name.
Titus Welliver, who plays Silas Adams, is one of the actors that David uses quite often in different shows that he does. Titus is one of those actors who David could throw three pages at him, I think, on the set, and he'd turn around and rattle them all back without a mistake. I don't know how he does it. It's quite phenomenal to me that he can do that. And Ian McShane actually runs neck and neck with Titus on that front. And in fact, most of our actors are pretty darn good at picking up the script that David throws at them at the last minute. And these two, I thought, just had such an amazing chemistry, and it just becomes very apparent as you watch them work together. They had a lot of fun on the set. Just always laughing and having a good time. That's sort of Titus's nature. He's a great mimic and does a great imitation of David Milch. Keeps us in stitches.
giving her great solace.
Thank you. Or you're welcome, I guess.
Thank you, Silas.
This look is just priceless.
And you're welcome.
Ha, Studler. It's the nigger General Field.
This is the arrival of the second African-American into Deadwood.
And I used to have this horse one.
There weren't really very many.
Yeah, old Nugget here.
Back in 1877, the year which this season takes place.
And apples in the private stables of a San Francisco dry goods.
This character is based on a real character, Samuel Fields, who called himself the Nigger General.
Yeah, I was delivering emerald earrings.
He had a business card that he used to pass around.
And a diamond bracelet.
And he called himself Samuel Fields,
Mr. Big Shot's
cosmopolite, which means a person who is at home in every place or a citizen of the world. That's what he liked to believe himself as. And he would take on all kinds of different jobs. A lot of times he would basically take care of, if men were sleeping around on their wives, he would take care of making sure that their wives didn't know that that was happening.
Oh, and
very interesting character in our show. This episode in particular, dealing with racial issues and having a strong storyline with women, again, is part of the overall theme of our show.
Then who's gonna
know how people sort of
general?
Organize themselves, and especially people who are in the minority or downtrodden or oppressed. It's very interesting to watch how they interact in a place that's lawless as they try to find their way in the world.
Even for a goddamn fool.
Yeah, well, I keep missing a place where it'd be a good time. Must be my goddamn foolishness.
You wouldn't suppose there'd be salt in the fucking find over there now, would you, Doris?
I don't understand.
I was wondering if maybe your new bosses, Maddie and Joni, are sending me more in my proper share.
Here again is another actress that impression. Actually was first cast as an extra.
I don't know.
She was cast as one of the whores in the Belly Union.
This is fucking
and then in the first episode,
for operation ahead of
we were doing a scene up on the balcony, you may recall, where Tolliver pulls her sort of out
trick.
Of the crowd and gives her to Joni Stubbs to take over to the Chaise and Me. Because of that, she ended up with this particular role. And that often happens on our show, again, because of David's sometimes improvised style in the setting up of a scene. He'll grab somebody that's an extra in a scene and say, I need you to say lines.
Thin.
You never know what's going to happen when you're working on Deadwood.
Clean shave.
I'm certain, though, he'll never give me any lines. That would be a big mistake.
He threw me into a wall last night.
But not a mistake to give lines to Mr. Powers Booth. He's a fine actor who we're lucky to have as part of our ensemble.
Pretext, sweetheart.
And he's truly a lot of fun to work with. I had a lot of scenes with him in this episode.
That was against his instructions.
He had all the girls facing the wall.
And you peeked. And was this more or less a push to the wall? Or did he fucking fling you?
I always like this shot with the... I think it's an elk or deer in the background there. It just seems strangely odd, as if he was watching the whole proceedings. I'm sure he has an opinion.
Mr. W. Jesus Christ.
I often marvel at our sets and how beautiful they look. How interesting they're dressed. Our production designer, Maria Queso, is so unbelievably talented and just puts so much detail into every single scene, every single set. Everywhere you look, there's all kinds of items that are of the period that she's done so much research.
Are you guessing? I guess I'm guessing.
Do you bet?
Yes, thank you. My trick got you upset.
I was in with him the night before.
I guessed he took to watching.
I presume we'll go back to wide shot up in the upper left somewhere. There's some sponges that are hanging back there, and those were actually contraceptive devices that the whores would use.
What would I do with him?
They would put them, you know, in the proper place and then hang them up to dry for use again, thinking that maybe that would help protect them. I don't think it was very effective, and I wouldn't recommend it, but that was what they did back then.
Reaching around behind you. Behind me and between.
This was a very interesting scene.
Through his pants.
To shoot because it wasn't really, even though there was the obvious sexual possibilities here, it really had nothing to do with that. And it was hard to really pull that off just by the nature of the way the scene was set up. Carrie, you know, has a certain affection for Mr. Walcott,
and
Joni certainly has a fascination with him, so it was an interesting, really interesting scene, I thought, to see them talking about him.
Congratulations, Doc, on your high.
When there's Trixie with all of her energy, Paula herself is a ball of energy. I just love her relationship with the doctor.
Are we fucking speaking?
One as might die in childbirth, more likely than us lucky others. But so sponged down in your disapproval when she was kicking the fucking dope, she's afraid now to seek your care.
I'll call on her.
Under some other fucking pretext.
Trixie's character, it's so often that she will be saying something that she's saying exactly what she means, but she never says it on the nose. She'll always say it in another way. It's part of her character, and it's amazing to me how David can pull that off, and somehow you always know what she really means.
Hey now, Miss Lady. How much do you want for that bottle?
What the fuck?
These two characters, you know, here we are in the middle of Deadwood with a ton of white men who are all basically misfits out trying to strike it rich. And in the middle of it, you've got a woman who dresses like a man and is a drunk, and a black man who suddenly find themselves becoming friends. These are the kind of moments that I think make Deadwood so special, so interesting.
And many still above ground.
To see how that happens.
And not scalped by the fucking heathens and their guts spread over the plains. You're a short nigger, aren't you?
For a fact.
My name's Jane.
I'm the nigger General Fields.
So sort of very purposely tried to put him in a place where he could really feel the rest of the town. You know, with people walking in between them.
Have a fucking drink.
And the fact that Jane is just so fearless.
Thanks.
Is a testament to her character. She was a brave woman in those times.
I don't care if she's a nigga drinking with me or drinking from the same bottle or hell. Stupid his fucking outfit is.
This here is the epaulette of a Union Army general.
Oh, and this here is the ass of a drunken shitbird. Finish this with me. If you can sit beside someone and not stink, fart.
I've been known to cut the odd fart. They've never stunk.
I got the self-same gift.
If I took advantage, I apologize.
You took no more advantage of me, Silas, than the Samaritan did the traveler from Jerusalem.
Good.
I should tell you, Silas, that the Mr. Swearingen I've heard you say you work for is named by Mrs. Garrett as her instrument in her husband's murder.
Named by Mrs. Garrett?
Yes.
As her instrument?
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Gotta love Titus's pink underwear.
Alice?
Well, Alice, your story don't get less
very attractive. That was actually, those were his own.
Wouldn't do such a thing?
Generates a fucking stream.
We had to pay him $10 to use them.
I see.
Yeah, well, that makes
sense. This, again, weird. Another scene where people aren't always who they appear to be in Deadwood, and that's part of the fun of the show as well.
You're asking me to. You want to meet him?
Please.
Why do I feel lucky we didn't meet across
the park? Mrs. Ringhausen is certainly a character who's quite devious, as is proved by this moment.
Silas.
Again, another priceless look. I mean, how can he resist?
Her bearing gives you suspicions as to her health?
No, not at all. My notes indicate that it had been a year since her last exam, and with a day-long lull between gunfights, I thought I'd have a look.
Little Bree,
I see.
Who plays Sophia,
coming along.
She also was... It's an interesting story how she became a character in the show. She was hired as the stand-in for somebody who we cast as Sophia. And on the first day of shooting, the young actress just wasn't quite up for it.
I have cared for
and we were in a dire situation,
well,
so we took Bree.
Can I ask after your
and
health?
Asked her if she would just say the lines and do everything we needed to do, because we didn't really have any choice at that point. There was nothing else we could shoot.
Weakness
and
treated.
She was an absolute
and
natural.
And you have nothing else to report.
Thank you for examining Sophia.
The rest is history. She became a series regular this season. And is just doing an unbelievable job for us. Comes in with a smile every day.
Quite adequate to the requirements of health. And
she's as much of a prankster as anybody else on the show. She's very good at getting people to get out of their chairs so that she could sit in their chair and watch the monitors. It's quite funny how she dupes everybody.
Particular competence as to the implications of anatomical anomalies.
And I presume having the time of her life.
Consequent of previous
these two have
illness,
had a lot of scenes together. It's fascinating to me to watch this woman who's come from New York, who never really would have expected to have this life, who's chosen to stay, and this doctor who has killed every patient he's ever really had to do anything serious to, you know, especially when he was a doctor in the Civil War. He's trying to take care of this woman. You know, she didn't trust him, and all he wanted was some trust. You know,
please.
Where else is she going to turn? So it's a really, really interesting and rich storyline.
My experience, Mr. Wilcott, come to making restitution for others' outlays, the rich can be tardy.
I'm just satisfying myself that my employer's getting what he's paying for.
Bills of sale drawn good and legal. Signature is genuine and witnessed. Join us, Commissioner.
Gentlemen, notice about the claims is in your newspaper publisher's hands. That the
and again,
Yankton
I think in this particular scene,
among local claim
you know, hugely thematic to the series
title,
overall.
Merrick found personally distressing.
He Walcott on the left, who represents money, big money.
No, no, he was
a government official.
In
they're all
case,
sort of plotting together.
It's manageable. I quite
of course,
stared him down.
Here comes the information that the government officials' plan of attack doesn't work out so well. So what else can happen except big money coming to the rescue?
Just the statement on the outside wall, and people are fucking riled.
Riled or frightened?
Riled, sir.
That's a type of unsettlement we ain't necessarily after.
Want to know where he's at? Who the fuck he thinks he is?
You want to manage this?
Sort of the story of America in a way.
Go on.
It's played out.
Maybe take
a small way
path.
In this particular scene.
What
everybody corrupt in their own way.
Mitigating as applied to a presumption
and
would
then
mean to lessen
how do the little people react?
Strength or rigor.
I ought to punch you in the fucking nose.
That's how they react.
Why would you punch me?
You had him here, didn't you? Give him your fucking words.
Yeah, of course,
words
the press
to
trying to explain what's really going on.
Which is short of saying I should have forced him to some purpose of my own.
Show me where the cocksucker is.
Interesting the way David weaves with all these really, really rich, deep, interesting characters.
And
weave, you know, the story of America.
Mitigating us into an ass fucking.
Ouch.
And then I yelled, "Put the fucking door down, Dan!"
That little moment there itself, just a small little piece of how we all sort of are. You know, they've had this situation happen in that earlier episode when Dan Doherty had to come and break the door down to rescue Al, and there they all are just ruminating about it. It's what we all do. And it was a great little moment there.
The county commissioner's in the camp.
Yeah, and that hooplehead Steve's about to punch Merrick for posting the notice, and I know that you got a liking for Merrick.
I want you to stop thinking now, Johnny, and only answer the question I'm going to ask you.
Yes, sir.
Where's the commissioner now?
The commissioner or Mr. Merrick?
The commissioner, Johnny.
If you know Ian's facial hair, where he had a lot of stubble, usually his character is where he doesn't have sideburns and mustache, is pretty clean shaven. Quite often on our show, we'll do additional shooting after we've completed an episode. Another scene will come up, or there'll be an idea that comes up during a scene, and it creates a new idea that David has for a previous episode. And, you know, there was an instance with Ian where we had to go back to shoot something for, not this episode, but a previous, I think the one previous, one small scene. We actually had to schedule it an entire week without him so that he could get his growth back, and we could go back and shoot it. So we often have, you know, a lot of our actors, almost all of them, this is their real hair. We do some, you know, mustaches and beards and sideburns and things, but a lot of the, especially the regular characters, all grow their own. But in between seasons, they need to go do a movie. You know, it's a big ordeal dealing with people's mustaches and sideburns. And especially characters who do a lot of different shows. You know, they'll come in, when we first meet them, they'll have a mustache. Next time we see them, they don't. We have to make one for them. Our makeup and hair department are always on their toes.
Look, I have said before,
and I guess they do a really good job. This is the second year in a row that they've been nominated for an Emmy by their peers. And in fact, this year they won. We were nominated for 11 Emmys for season 2. And so far, we've won for makeup and hair. Janie Bryan, our costume designer, won for her wardrobe designing. Maria Queso won for production design. And James Glennon won for his cinematography on this particular episode. There are still three categories that, for which the Emmys have not been given out as I do this commentary. It's a Saturday. They're going to be given out tomorrow night. That's for me for directing this episode. The show for Best Drama, and Ian McShane is nominated for Best Actor. And somebody out there in the world knows who's won, but we don't yet. We'll find out tomorrow night, and by the time you hear this, we'll all know if we were winners or losers. But clearly, working on this show, we can never lose.
That tone will collect your broken jaw.
I don't need another fucking question, because I've located the fact that I was seeking, which is the whereabouts of the fucking commissioner. And whoever wants can come with me.
Dangerous turn, Mr. Tolliver.
Yes. Temper loosened my tongue.
You got gall. Coming before me prettier than ever.
Are you all right?
I'm the fucking man. That's all to say on that. Why do you know this new commissioner?
His notice on the claims has people...
It's interesting also for our show, if you look, there's the slight scar on Bullock. He's been, you know, smashed in the head by an Indian. He's been smashed in the head by Swearingen. Swearingen's all beat up. It's interesting what David Milch will do to his lead actors. To keep them in line. That, of course, is a small joke, but it's interesting that they'll take them anywhere they need to go without worry about what they may, the lead actors may look like. And these guys, again, just pull it off.
Yankton. Exactly. They're too busy stealing to study human nature.
Did you ring Al?
This, too, is as part of what I call being a pivotal episode for the season.
No, then get the fuck out.
This is a scene in which Swearingen and Bullock are really, really coming together, which I think I certainly never expected when I first started working on the show and read the scripts. And it's a very interesting place that the story of the town is going.
Had you vision as well as sight, you would recognize within me not only a man, but an institution and the future as well.
Fuck you. Fuck the institution. And fuck the future.
You cannot fuck the future, sir. The future fucks you.
Come out from that cage, you billiard ball-looking cocksucker.
I do not take orders from hooligans.
Come out.
Another thing I love in the show is when he just called him a billiard ball looking fuck or something like that. It's fun to just hear how certain characters refer to other characters throughout the series sometimes. It's a great little nuance that David puts in the show over and over again. I haven't called too many people billiard ball looking fucks, but I'm probably gonna start soon.
Fuck Tolliver.
The mob is an ungodly creature, sir.
Stand away or be shot. He's under protection of the law.
You got their fucking attention.
Fuck him anyway.
Don't get me started. Do not get me started, little nigga general.
If something gotta go in front of nigga, and don't it always, I prefer short to little.
Short nigga's a deal. And I am a girl.
This particular scene was probably one of the most unbelievable scenes I've ever read.
Call me just plain nigga.
When I first got the pages, just the unabashed use of the word nigger by Franklin Ajayi, who plays the nigger general, and by Jane. It was just unbelievable to me, and the fact they were able to pull it off, sitting there on that bench in the middle of town, just spoke volumes about, you know, racial issues in such a unique way. And then the fact that he got up and walked away here, just because he saw people walking up the street, and he knew there was trouble, and he knew that the trouble could follow him if he wasn't careful. This is just unbelievable storytelling on the part of David Milch.
Wait till I take
and then Jane, who takes such pride in being a deputy, wants to get Bill's robe out of there. Wild Bill Hickok's robe that Charlie gave her in episode 1. You know, she doesn't want that to be disgraced by this billiard ball looking guy. Sorry, Stephen. He's coming into the jail room, the jail where she has been sleeping.
Beating short of murder might have done you considerable good.
It was, I think, again, a very brave move on the part of David to kill Wild Bill in season 1, in the 4th episode. The truth was he was originally going to be killed in the 3rd episode, but you can see even by that moment that his presence is still, you know, hovering in the camp.
Fellas like yourself, that's hard to understand. Your foundation's sunk deep. Frameworks, first-rate mason work. Nothing unfinished in you, or rotten or damaged. You're sick.
Five long years talking to nobody.
Oh, Stedler, you got enough problems of your own. You don't need other bodies, especially a fool.
I hope you fucking strangle under there.
Marcus, even on that 100.
If you don't get your fucking thumb down, I'm gonna run this pitchfork through it.
We dragged the nigger from the livery to our pitch pot.
Speaking of Wild Bill Hickok, gentleman on the left there. So right there on the right now, that's Cade Carradine, that's Keith's son. I think it's just hysterical the way this character trying to rile up his mob just can't come up with anything that makes any sense, so he just decides, let's go get somebody. It's David Milch's version of the mob mentality.
Or we could just grab the nigger.
Your pelvic girdle
does show the effects of your childhood illness. Your labor may be difficult.
When you say difficult,
I have counseled patients on the basis of their anatomy against taking pregnancies to term. I do not make that argument with you.
Again, these two together are always...
Do you distinguish between difficult
money.
And dangerous?
Yes. And I think for me to direct this particular episode, it is so multi-layered. So many scenes with...
It adds pain. Difficult in
different characters together, especially since you might that haven't been together before, and then characters that have been together many times, and just storylines branching out in so many different ways. That was very fortunate for me. I was blessed by just the most unbelievable script, written by Victoria Morrow and polished up by David, as he does to every script. And for it to be the first time that I had an opportunity to direct, I was very, very lucky. And it was a very enriching experience because there were so many different types of scenes that I got to do.
To be honest, Doctor, I'm living into the thought that I've any choice at all.
You know what I'm fucking writing? Fucking nigger general.
This scene in particular was a very, very difficult one to pull off. There was,
who will outlast me?
It was mostly written in description, and then David added a lot of these lines on the set. It was very much about being in Hostetler's head about what he's feeling about how dangerous the camps become. And then, you know, you don't see anybody until he pulls back. You know, he's there writing his will, and then there's the mob. If you notice in the background how the mob is not really that interested in what's going on, but they don't know what else to do because they've gotten caught up in the situation. And here even character of Steve calls out for them to come and help, you know. And ultimately, as we see, they did. They don't even know why they're doing it. Isn't that what happens sometimes?
They grabbed up a nigger.
Where'd a fucking nigger come into this?
Hoople's got him from the livery.
And in this particular scene, there's a moment that I think I may be the only one who is really aware of, but...
You've added a fucking irrelevance.
I asked Bill Sanderson to do this, put his head down, his eyes down, to kind of match what he said to his underling in the earlier scene, to Richardson. And I love that moment when he just looks down. It's an homage to the earlier scene.
You got a better chance waking up looking normal.
Again, Jane referring to him waking up normal is...
Don't act like you know, Jane, just because you're already drunk.
Those kind of moments always make me laugh.
Ignorant cocksucker.
He come over winter when you was gone.
That's ignorant. I met him today.
Why do you ask about him, Charlie?
It looked like he was going to get done for. I mean, I couldn't see to be sure.
As varied as all the characters in that room are, all four of those people, all extremely talented.
I'm thirsty.
That's how varied their personalities are behind the scenes as well. And you can't imagine how much fun it is to work on this show when you have all these different people of all these different talents, you know, hanging around every day. A lot of times people are up at the ranch just, you know, for fittings, wardrobe, whatever, and it seems like it's always a party, so to speak. We have a really good time making this show. This was a scene that a lot of people, when we were filming it, couldn't even watch. It was really interesting to see how the crew themselves reacted. Even Bullock coming there, seeing what's happening, there's that moment where he hesitates, and it's because he can't even believe it. It's that sort of fascination for a very slight moment. But literally, there were several crew people who had to just walk away. And Franklin was a trooper, being there, shirtless, getting thrown in the mud. And sometimes, you know, we had a stuntman do it, but oftentimes he was lying there on his own. There's those antlers.
Cunt!
Richardson, who's a...
May I,
I guess you could say a little bit out there,
with you.
Has decided that
what
those antlers are
going
to
of you going over the columns?
Take on some sort of religious significance to them and be able to protect Alma from afar.
God help me for enjoying you out there, even only to abuse me.
The kind of idea that I think only Milch could come up with.
Well, I also wouldn't mind getting fucked.
A last try at twinning these columns, then you'll have your fucking wish.
The correct answer in each instance is $127.49.
You fuck.
When we film scenes at night, we sort of have an overall rule on Deadwood that the world of Deadwood is lit by flame at all times, whether it's the big flame in the sky or if it's candles or oil lamps or otherwise, and we take great pains to try to make it always feel like what you're looking at is only lit by some sort of flame. Obviously, we have film lights and we have to get exposures and things like that, but as you see the torch in the background, I mean, that's how it was, and that's how we try to make it look, and hopefully we do. We want it always to feel real.
Anyone else looking on you today?
I did have another visitor, yes.
It's a little scary at times. The entire ranch, all those buildings are literally just made of wood.
Please,
some of them have been there a very long time.
Thank you so much.
Some of them are brand new buildings that we built. But all of them are made out of wood, and we have a fire marshal who's with us all the time, helping us to make sure that everything is safe and secure, especially because we have so much fire around all the time.
And he
even in the last year, right before this season started, there was a major, major brush fire in the area around where we shot, and the airplanes and the helicopters that were fighting it with the water-dropping aircraft were dropping water over the ranch. They were spraying the ranch every time they'd go by to make sure that it didn't catch on fire, because one errant spark would take the whole place down. And in fact, it did burn down about 15 years ago, I believe it was. The entire ranch had burned down, and the people who owned it rebuilt it. And then we took over and transformed it into Deadwood.
You're occupied now at the hardware store.
When we first took over that ranch, I remember when I was first, I think I was the only person employed on the show at the time, and I went to the Melody Ranch. I was sitting there in the middle of the ranch looking at it, and it had been used for a different show, and it literally looked like Disneyland. The ground was flat, and all the colors were different primary colors, blues, red, yellows. And again, Maria, in the span of about 2 months, transformed it into what it looks like today. We brought in tons of dirt, turned it into the muddy mud fest that it is. It looks like what you watch today.
Thank you.
When we work on the street, we're usually covered in mud. In fact, as I speak to you now, because I'm still wearing the shoes from the set, my boots are quite muddy. It's hard not to get home at night, and I often forget to take off my boots, and I walk into my house and end up mud all over the place.
Hello there.
$127.49. Both columns. Separate, verified.
Lying with aplomb. You've got the true calling.
What you heard otherwise, it's none of your business.
I didn't hear anything else.
The whore and the Jew. I don't know what to say about that. But with a name like Feinberg, I'm just going to leave it alone right now.
Work on your column now.
My own darling wife, Agnes. I have but a few moments left before this letter starts.
This here is another example
I
of
in my life,
how to see me now, Wild Bill Hickok continues to affect the camp.
Never prospected a moment
a letter that he wrote a year ago
him.
Or so is now in the hands of Walcott and transforms him for a moment.
We will be so happy. He spells like a child. Sure is spelled S-H-U-R-E.
Is it a very long letter?
No, as you're about to discover.
There's very few details that David puts into the show, I think, that don't somehow come back around in some significant way somewhere along the road. It never ceases to amaze me how someday a scene will show up and it'll reference something that happened early in the first season.
Agnes, darling.
That's even happening as we're doing season three.
We never meet
it's
again.
The brilliant storytelling that I think is fascinating us all. Shot,
I will gently breathe the name of my wife, Agnes. And with wishes even for my enemies, I will make the plunge and try to swim to the other shore.
Garrett Dillahunt, who plays Walcott, as many of you know, also played Jack McCall in season one.
I am a man.
Why'd we use him in season two? Because he's such a damn good actor.
He's taken off.
I can do that.
Seems to me there's reabsorption of the hemorrhage.
What the fuck good is less blood in my eye? I want use of my fucking limbs.
I understand.
I have spent my last day of bed here in secondhand news from imbeciles.
Strike you as overweening, Al, setting nature to a schedule.
I'm not setting terms for nature. I'm setting it for myself.
Who has dominion over nature? Al Swearingen, owner and proprietor.
As to when he takes his leave, you're A1 fucking right. Well, I don't understand.
It's only David Melcher would put a game of charades in the middle of a scene like this.
Well, why the fuck do you whisper?
Sean Bridgers cracks me up, this character of Johnny Burns.
Doc. Sheriff.
Pithy and civil.
Of course, the doc referring to the fight in the first episode between the two guys here.
Commissioner's all right.
Again, a crucial moment for the series, I think. This scene solidifying the teaming up of these two.
You wipe the rim of that bottle, I'll knock you out from my present vantage.
Over a bottle of whiskey.
They're coming against us.
Post a notice like that. Not award even one commissioner of the three to local citizenry.
I'll guarantee
this is just, I think, I just love this scene between these two guys.
Politicians ain't got balls for
I remember we were shooting up it, I kept thinking of the first time that Bullock walked into the hardware
Someone's
store.
Back in their play.
How belligerent these two were with each other.
Over for us.
Is it Tolliver?
Tolliver is us. They ain't gonna
now they've
Tolliver
come to understand each other and realize how they can...
This early in the game.
How they need each other in certain ways and can benefit each other.
There's a nigger in the fucking woodpile somewhere.
And it tells a great story Someone of how people work together. And speaking of that, Tim Oliphant and Ian McShane, two great actors, working together alone in this episode a few times. It's I was very lucky because usually they're working, you know, their minions are around them or their partners are around them and they're in groups. And in this case, having them alone together was pretty special.
The money's on you.
Here comes some pain for you.
This was a scene... When you work with David as a director, you can only plan so much. And I learned, and most of the directors learn, it's best to plan the least and just watch the scene and see what happens when we're rehearsing it and then go to work. This was one where the night before I had planned this whole singular shot, basically. Dolling around on a circular
not
track around, you know, trying to hide the gruesomeness of the wounds that the general has. And then this moment when the commissioner pops up in the background. And I had it all planned out. It was all perfectly figured out. We had all the equipment there to do it. And then 3 minutes before we finish the scene before, they come to me and hand me new pages. And it has all the same words, but all mixed around differently, and the timing of everything was different. And I thought, oh, my big, beautiful shot that's going to show off what a brilliant director I can possibly be is now ruined. Somehow I managed to pull some of it off that I was able to actually do the whole thing in one. We decided to do a little cutting there, but I managed to make it work in the end somehow. I don't remember exactly what it was, but
I guess he'll understand
it. It just sort of spoke to me about when I did the next episode. I didn't plan quite as much. I just decided I'll let it all happen before my very eyes, because it always happens on our show that when you plan, David will make sure that you unplan. And it turns out to be a very healthy thing. So that was episode 5, and this is the list of all the people, the amazing people on our cast and crew that have helped make this episode so great. They carried me on their shoulders and got me through my first directing gig. It is definitely a privilege to work on Deadwood. We're all very, very lucky to be able to work with a master storyteller, David Milch. It's hopefully entertaining for our audience. I know that every day on the set, our crew and our cast is entertained by each other and the work that we're doing. And hopefully we'll be able to do this for many years to come. We have great partners in HBO. They spend what it takes to make it great. And I hope that you enjoyed my commentary.